This is day 5 of this April 2012 7-day session. And before we return to our text, I'd like to read something I haven't read in Taisho in about 3 years. The sound of the geese honking overhead reminded me of this marvelous piece about the creation of flowing forms in water and air. It's an exquisite. What's described is an exquisite mirror of the Sesshin effort, the effort of birds, geese in flight, very much reflects what the group exertion of Sesshin, the dynamics of Sesshin, and in particular as well as the relationship between the teacher and other Sesshin participants. It speaks pretty much for itself, so I won't comment on it any more than I just did. It's from a book called Sensitive Chaos, and that's the subtitle, The Creation of Flowing Forms in Water and Air. And the book is by Theodore Schwenk. And he's talking about the studies of a scientist by the name of Schieferstein. And it has diagrams that he begins by commenting on. This is a picture of the flight of birds in migration. Each bird lies on a wave which is made in the air by the leader. The beats of their wings follow the ups and downs of the wave and simply make visible what, as a vibrating aerial form, surrounds and bears them all in the arrow formation. Each bird flies in a fixed position in the aerial form, and the form itself unites all the individual birds. A bird does not need much strength, for it is as though the movement of the wave of air were to raise and lower its wings for it. If one of the birds has an excess of energy, it will do more than simply allow itself to be carried along. With the beating of its wings, it will strengthen the whole wave, will infuse the aerial form with energy, from which all will benefit who would, on their own account, no longer have the strength to fly. These take energy from the whole moving field of air. Indeed, even the leading bird itself draws energy from this field. Schieferstein says, "The current error that the bird flying at the apex of the triangle has to work considerably harder than those following it must be corrected. The wave of the field of air streams, created reciprocally by all the separate birds, spreads out in space with the speed of sound, and therefore, as the speed at which the birds fly is much slower than sound, it precedes them considerably, so that the leading bird can, if necessary, take energy from the field just as can all the others. The arrow formation is a totality in which the separate birds lie embedded like organs. A new body has been created out of air in which, as with the body of sound of an orchestra, the single instrument to a great extent merges into the whole. It is, however, a necessary part of the whole. The separate birds are linked together by the surrounding air as though by elastic threads. The air, which connects the birds like an elastic medium, acts like a muscle. It unites the different limbs of the formation into a unity which was not there before and is caused to do this by a higher being, namely, the group soul of these birds. One might also say that this group soul manifests itself in the density of air and acts as an integrating muscular system. The elastic properties of muscles are indeed similar to the elasticity of the air. In a muscle, these properties of air are simply embodied and made visible in matter. Thus it comes about that, during a long flight over many hundreds of miles, each single bird, elastically connected with the whole flight, beats its wings exactly as many times as all the others in the formation. The entire process is an aerial form, an organic whole moving through the air. The bird is a creature of the air. It is born out of the air and entrusts itself to it. It cannot possibly be abandoned by the air. Now back to our text, the teachings of Japanese Zen master Musō Kokushi from the 14th century. This book we're reading from is called Dream Conversations on Buddhism and Zen, translated by Thomas Cleary. It is said that people with intense determination for enlightenment neglect even to eat and sleep. Such people do become tired and do become hungry, but they rest and eat in the midst of their work and therefore are not hindered even when sleeping or eating. They rest and eat in the midst of the work. I think what he's saying is that when we are dwelling in this no mind of mu, or this no mind of no thought, whatever our practice is, if we are not pursuing thoughts in even in our work, there is a way in which the mind is at rest. If people who lack such determination go without eating or sleeping, they will become ill. This will hinder their practice, so they are encouraged to eat enough to overcome hunger and sleep, enough to overcome fatigue. This does not mean, however, that they should forget the work while eating or sleeping. You know, in the verse that at the end of each evening, at the end of each evening, sitting in Sesshin, even as night darkens the green earth, the wheel turns, death follows birth. Strive as you sleep, with every breath, that you may wake past day, past death. This is something we've been doing now for, well, as long as I've been at the center. And we got it from Japan. It's a translation from the Japanese. The thing that is puzzling to some people is this injunction to strive as you sleep with every breath. Here Musō says, we should not forget the work while eating or sleeping. Well, the eating, it's obvious. You maintain the awareness of one's practice while eating. There's no reason to drop it. Sleeping is less obvious. I'm not sure I understand this myself. But certainly when you're working all day long on a koan, it doesn't stop when you go to sleep. There are reports, very unusual reports, but there are reports of people actually coming to awakening while sleeping. There are many mysteries of sleep and consciousness that have yet to be unraveled. Maybe they will always be those mysteries, but even though it is counterintuitive, how can you strive as you sleep with every breath? I think there's something there that we maybe don't need to understand so perfectly, but rather take the spirit of it. An ancient Zen master gives this advice: when you walk, watch the walking. When you sit, watch the sitting. When you recline, watch the reclining. When you see and hear, watch the seeing and hearing. When you notice and cognize, watch the noticing and cognizing. What a word, cognize. Think. Okay, let's just make it think. When you notice and think, watch the noticing and thinking. When joyful, watch the joy. When angry, watch the anger. That's the end of the quote of this ancient master. And then Musso says, working in this way will lead to awakening. Of course, what he's talking about in all of this is mindfulness, awareness, the very opposite of a wandering mind. We need this mindfulness in order to notice when the mind is wandering, so that we can return it to the koan that we're working on, or in the case of breath practice, to just drop the thoughts and get fully engaged with what we're doing. One of the definitions of the word Buddha is awareness. Generally, you see it translated as the enlightened one, but what this really implies, or one way to understand it at least, is it implies this wakeful awareness that is behind all of our ordinary functioning. There is one who is aware at all times. Who is that one? What is that one? What is Mu? There is a popular practice commonly found in Buddhist sutras and Zen writings that consists of looking upon all phenomena as if they were dreams or illusions. This practice is in the realm of method and is not an ultimate teaching. Here, let's look at this distinction between method and ultimate teaching. Method, we could say, is a means to an end. We're doing this in order to effect such and such a change. The ultimate teaching in Zen is going beyond methods, going beyond using the practice in an instrumental way as a means to an end, but to lose oneself in the practice for its own sake. This is the key to resolving a koan. This is the key to reaching a breath samadhi or a mu samadhi, is to get beyond trying to use the practice to get something out of it or effect a change, but just to completely merge with it. And this practice he refers to, looking upon all phenomena as if they were dreams or illusions, it doesn't have the radical simplicity of true Zen practice. It's still contriving the mind to set up a kind of a model, a mental model or a template whereby apparently, I've never done this practice, but whereby you're just consciously trying to mindfully remember to see everything in terms of a dream or illusion. I'm sure it has value to it. There are a lot of Buddhist practices that outside of Zen that have value to them. Metta meditation unquestionably has value and power to it. This probably does. Reflecting on death. There are old Buddhist practices where you examine the constituents of the body and so forth. These are just things I've heard of here and there. But it's not this crystalline fundamental practice of Zen that is beyond method. He goes on, secular literature and folk sayings use the image of things being like dreams or phantasms to mean that everything is transient. In Buddhism, the implication is that phenomena are ultimately insubstantial, but nevertheless conditionally manifest. It's a lot of 50-cent words here. Ultimately insubstantial, but nevertheless conditionally manifest. So, ultimately, nothing has any fixed substance to it. Everything is empty, shunyata. And yet, because of the interplay of causes and conditions, phenomena give the appearance of being real. They manifest as phenomena, but in their essence, they're empty. There's no substance to them. They're like mirages. And yet, even one who has seen into emptiness, who has awakened, doesn't go around seeing people and things as mirages. There's a detachment that comes from seeing the insubstantiality of the world of form. But it's not like any kind of a dual level of seeing. The best analogy for this seeing and understanding that things are insubstantial, but nevertheless seeing them as having form that I've ever come up with is a hologram. We know, anyone who knows what holograms are, we know that there's nothing of substance there. You can wave your hand right through, let's say, the image of a person. That's the ones I've seen in museums, is a head, a face. It gives the illusion of being a real person, but there's nothing there. I sometimes wonder if there had been holograms in the ancient times, whether the masters would have used that as an example. Or one of the most elegant passages from any sutra. This is from the Lankavatara Sutra, where the Buddha said, "Things are not what they appear to be, nor are they otherwise." And then he adds, "This represents this." Seeing things as both ultimately insubstantial but still conditionally manifesting, This represents a balance, avoiding both reification and nihilism. Reification meaning imagining something has substantial reality to it that doesn't, and nihilism denying any kind of reality to it. This is why it's called the middle way. Buddhism is, well, there are different axes in which you can understand this Dharma as the middle way, but this is one of them, the middle way between denying the form of things denying the emptiness of things. All of this is just words. It's just concepts until one has confirmed it through awakening. But it's I know from past experience that it can be very helpful in understanding, at least intellectually understanding this work and this work that we're doing. It is said that people who are truly on the way do not discuss judgments of others. This does not mean that they make judgments but suppress them. It means they do not see people in terms of self and other. The third patriarch of Zen said, "In the realm of being as is, there is no other and no self." A sutra says, "The nature of reality is like an ocean. You should not say there is right or wrong." If people view the world in terms of distinctions between others and self, they will inevitably make judgments of right and wrong. If they entertain views of right and wrong, they are not true practitioners of the way, even if they refrain from expressing their views. Well, he's presenting very high standards here. Right and wrong, notions of right and wrong, and the reactions that follow those are so deeply ingrained in us. But what he's saying here is that if we can see through this dualism, this dualistic illusion of self and other as some ultimate distinction, then if we could do it thoroughly enough, then there would be no such judgments. Just things are what they are. The great Sufi mystic Rumi had some wonderful words about this. "Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other don't make any sense." Of course, he's talking here about what we call samadhi, which means the fusion or the merging of subject and object. This is an experience that anyone here now in this room can reach through this persistent returning the mind to the practice, which means through complete faith in the practice, and learning to not traffic in thoughts, but just rest in the practice, in the mu, in the breath, whatever one is working on. But it has to be complete commitment, not just skittering around the edges of the practice and within, in the back of the mind, this ideas of having it, you know, be useful to get us somewhere, but thorough, complete, single-minded absorption in the practice. And then he offers a little device here. Rather than try to refrain from discussing judgments of others, therefore, students of the Dharma should turn around and reflect, who is it that speaks of others' right and wrong? That one that the who is alluding to, that one is beyond right and wrong, beyond all dichotomies. We could also say, who is it that thinks of others right and wrong? A sutra says that people take the physical constitution to be their own body and take the reflections of sense data to be their own mind. And then Musso says, what this sutra saying means is that what ordinary people think to be their self is not the true self. And if you do not know what your true self is, you cannot see others as they really are either. So if your ideas of self and of others are both untrue, how can you judge right and wrong? And yet, there is this matter of ethics, and in that realm, we do need to make decisions. And even with people, we need to know who to associate with and who to avoid, really, if we want to give our practice the most support we can. But it doesn't, technically speaking, it doesn't mean we have to label the person as right or wrong. We just have to be able to discriminate between what causes harm and what doesn't cause harm. What actions create suffering, what actions do not create suffering. That we have to be able to decide. Even though at any given moment our decision, that very discrimination, can be flawed, it can be imperfect, but that's how we navigate through the world, is making choices about whom we associate with and also what we do. Even those who have set aside all judgments of right and wrong and do not view people in terms of self and other cannot be said to be truly on the way as long as they have not seen the original state before personal history. Another way of saying that is that what is my original self before my parents gave birth to me? It's a well-known breakthrough koan in Japan. A way to see this original state is to turn the attention inward. What is it that distinguishes and defines self and other, body and mind? What is it that thinks of right and wrong and gain and loss? In ancient times, Nan Yue went on to become a great Chinese master. Nan Yue went to the sixth patriarch of Zen. When the patriarch saw him approaching, he asked, "What is it that has come in this way?" Nan Yue was unable to answer, and so he withdrew. And he spent 8 years working on this question. What is it? Until he finally had a great realization. Returning to the sixth patriarch, Nan Wei replied, "It would not be accurate to refer to it as something." So that was his words. Only then did Nan Wei receive the approval of the Zen patriarch. It's not as poetic as you'd want someone to come up with after a deep realization. It would not be accurate to refer to it as something. But of course, it's the way he said this. It's his manner. It's the way he carried himself back in to see the sixth patriarch. This is what counts, not the words. And then Musso continues, "It may seem that Nan Yue's inability to understand and answer immediately shows that he was dull. In actuality, however, the fact that he pursued the question, what is it that has come, to the very end, and ultimately came back with the answer, is evidence of his sharpness. Without this penetrating inquiry, you can never become enlightened." This distinction between the sharp and the dull is one that crops up a lot in translations of Chinese Zen texts. I think Americans are self-judgmental enough without continuing to use these kind of terms. But since he did, let's just appreciate his point here, that his inability, Nan Yue's inability to respond, that he was tongue-tied when the sixth patriarch threw this question at him, could be understood at the time as that he was slow. He was kind of dull. But Musso here emphasizes that we can't. There's no point in making such judgments. Look at what he did with that. Yes, he was stymied when the sixth patriarch posed that question, but look what he did with it, and his perseverance, and what it led to. The speed with which one comes to awakening is no measure of the real capacity of someone, a true practitioner. And I would further say that even failing to come to awakening in this lifetime is no real judgment on someone's spiritual capacity. The Chinese have a way of acknowledging that even if one doesn't come to awakening in this lifetime, one will then in one's next lifetime, if you work your whole life, even though you don't come to awakening in this lifetime, then you have positioned yourself to be poised in your next lifetime to finish the work. That's the word, that's the phrase they use, finish the work. Here's another entry. There are people who say they believe in the Dharma or in Zen who have practiced for years but without effect. The question is, what effects are they looking for? And then he raises a number of secondary or inferior motivations for practicing. Some people want to be known or want to gain something for themselves. Some people pray to Buddhas and spirits to avert disaster and gain good fortune. Some people study in hopes of gaining knowledge. Some people perform esoteric practices to get supernatural powers. Some people practice arts and skills to outdo others. You could say martial arts and the other traditional East Asian arts. Some people practice curing in an effort to heal sickness. In such affairs, one may talk about effects or their absence, but the message of Zen is not on this order. I'm glad to say that people that I've worked with over the years, of all the people I've worked with over the years, there are few that have any of these as motivations. You know, it sometimes, here's a little flight of fancy, it sometimes occurs to me that there may come a time in 50 years or 100 years or where we will look back at this age, this birth of Zen practice in the West as a kind of a golden age, at least in terms of the purity of motivation. You read these texts, these old texts, and you read between the lines, or even just read the lines, you can infer that there were all kinds of monks who were in the monastery, going through the motions, showing up for sittings and so forth, doing the chanting and devotions, who really had no spiritual aspiration. They were more, many of them, it seems, were vulnerable to these kinds of corrupt motivations. I don't see it here. I don't see it. It is a privilege to work in a sangha where it isn't contaminated by all these secondary things. Of course, we can always say that all of us could have a more profound commitment and see that translate into greater exertion and greater enlightenment. But at least it doesn't have these other things that that taint the sangha, the Western sangha. And this is not just my own idea. This, I was told by the Roshis at both of the Zen temples I trained at in Japan. Both of them said to me privately, Zen is dying in Japan and being reborn in America. There's no reason to feel pride in that, but to be grateful, at least, that so far, that people who come to practice, certainly people who come to Sesshin, do have this aspiration that is really counts. As far as the message of Zen is concerned, he continues, it has been said, this is inherent in everyone, complete in every individual, not less in ordinary people, not more in sages. It is also said, here's Musso quoting the third patriarch, the author of Affirming Faith and Mind, it is complete like cosmic space without lack or excess. Or in our chanting rendition of the same text, the way is perfect like vast space where there's no lack and no excess. Of course, this is our true nature. He's talking about this original nature that we all have in common in equal measure. No one more, no one less. And then Musso comments, if you think you get some effect from practicing the Dharma, this is like seeing excess in vast space. If you think there is no effect, this is like seeing lack in vast space. In either case, you miss the point. So the point is beyond effect and no effect. So what does that mean? What is the point? It's just this. No future, no past. Just this. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.